Rob Wolf, Andy D is back with episode 24, Paleolithic Solution. How are you, buddy?
I'm caffeinated. You're not.
But I think I sound good this week. People at the gym comment, you know, after the first few days. Now I'm on day 10. Like, I feel good.
Yeah, gray zombie-like pallor has kind of lifted from you. So, yes.
Someone actually asked me if I was intoxicated. Apparently, I was so goofy about day 3.
See, I was saying, like, the whole auditory and visual hallucinations start kicking in, you know, so.
Well, I was not intoxicated, although I wished I was.
Yeah.
And I wanted to also say that, you know, several people friended me on Facebook with the like, tagline, hey, I'm joining you in the with the no caffeine revolution. So we'll see how this plays out for all those poor souls.
Nothing good will come of this. I can tell you that right now.
Dude, day 10, I'm good. I'm good. We'll see how I feel after 30 days. And the other thing I wanted to mention is I finally sat down and watched the Boondock Saints 2.
Mm.
And it was a painful 2 hours. There were some good scenes and some parts I enjoyed, but as usual, really paled in the comparison. I think waiting 15 years or whatever to do the follow-up is problematic, especially when one of the main actors definitely had what I would consider some poor plastic surgery done.
Nice.
And at certain angles, you're like, ooh, that's his face. So, you know, I think I'm just going to stick with the Boondock Saints 1 and pretend they never made the second one.
Cool. Well, you know, I think, you know, The Empire Strikes Back is legitimately the only sequel which was better.
Yeah, there's actually a little article this week in Entertainment Weekly about that being the best of the Star Wars series.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. So, all right, man. Well, back to the questions. Anything you want to say about the book? It's sunny today, Rob. I feel like your things should be picking up for you. You just went to New York. I mean,
did a gig in Hoboken and Brooklyn, and that was awesome. Really good crowds. The Hoboken crowd had so many questions that we were actually behind schedule an hour at one point, but we managed to catch up and finish on time. That was really good. The book is going well. We're just duking it out with some distributors on some tagline sub-issues and some cover art and some different stuff like that, and all I want to do is write my damn book and be done. And so it's just the details that are involved with finishing a project like this up, but it's getting close.
I think you should just self-publish it, drive around the country in your little car, pack up Nikki and Keystone, and you can just, you know, hawk it out the back.
I'm in. That sounds like a way better option at this point.
I feel like by week 3, Nikki and Keystone would be at home.
No, by like week 3 of suggesting that, I would be all alone for sure, and I would not have the gatto. I would lose the custody battle on that. So
that would be a sad state of affairs for sure. So
yeah,
I guess we'll go mainstream, Rob. Good work.
Cool. My pleasure.
All right. First question today is from Eric D. By the way, he says he's addicted to listening to these things, and he's turning some of the guys in his JITS classes onto your website. So instead of 15, you may have 18 or 19 listeners.
Nah, it's a lie. The FTC has put a block on anything more than about 8 listeners. So any reports of more listeners is completely hyped.
Eventually, I'm just going to draw a line in the sand, and if like we make it to episode 100, we're just going to end these jokes. They will be banned.
No, then we'll figure out something else to be idiots about. So,
anyway, Eric has a fast question about post workout. He had posted before that he has been eating 3 meals a day, low carb, with all carbs coming from veggies such as broccoli, spinach, red cabbage, asparagus, etc., and was not eating a post-workout meal. Started feeling lethargic, so he added post-workout per your recommendation. Also, according to your reply in earlier podcast, switched my JIT strength and conditioning from CrossFit strength bias to 2 times a week of ring-based warm-up, squat, shoulder press, body weight, press, pull one day, and the other being ring-based warm-up, deadlift, bench, or clean, bodyweight pull, and bodyweight press. Before I go on, how many freaking acronyms can we have for CrossFit, CrossFit Strength Bias, CrossFit Football, CrossFit Max Effort? Like,
now we have West Side.
Yeah, CrossFit West Side.
With Crazy Louie at the helm.
We're just going to call it strength and conditioning. Anyway, I've been using the following post-workout. On strength days, I eat an organic sweet potato with cinnamon on top, can of salmon, and 2 eggs. On JITS nights, I ate the salmon, eggs, and then a very small shake of 1 cup frozen spinach, 1 spoon cocoa, splash light coconut milk, and then between a quarter cup and full cup of natural blueberries, depending on intensity and time spent rolling. The lethargic feeling has gone away, as well as lasting soreness, and energy in class seems to be going well. My question is if this looks solid, or maybe I should eat more carbs post-workout on JITS days and no post-workout carbs post-strength. Maybe I'm splitting hairs, but you've helped so many people so far, considering you've done JITS, which is awesome, by the way. You're the perfect guy to ask this stuff. Concerns are staying strong and eventually trying to get deadlift and squat up to 2 times body weight and staying below 10% body fat. Not all about vanity here either. I perform better being lean and generally feel better about life.
You know, honestly, I could go either way with this, but generally I would just throw carbs into the more glycolytic demanding activity. And so that strength work really isn't going to take a whole lot of starch out of his britches. So I don't really see a need for it unless Eric's just not recovering from his post-workout refeeds. And if that's the case, like if he's say like getting geared up for a tournament or something and he's upping his volume and that one meal post-workout isn't quite doing it, then, you know, he could look at a couple of meals, post-workout meal being larger in carbs, secondary meal being a little bit smaller but some more dense carbs. That's when you might start considering a shake, like looking at something like the OPT post-workout recovery shake and stuff like that. But most people I find do great. Like Glenn always did fine on the yam, sweet potato, salmon kind of gig. And we played with shakes and didn't really notice that big of a difference with it. But I think what he's doing is fine. I would only tweak the a secondary meal with more carbohydrate if you're feeling like you're not performing.
I'm kind of nauseated at the idea of a 1 cup frozen spinach in your shake.
I was trying to just glide right past that and hope no one else was going to commentate on that. So,
like, I was like, coconut milk, cocoa, blueberries, sounds good. It's frozen spinach, okay.
we need to get Eric's address and we'll send him some Polican like mixed greens, like the green superfood stuff that's all dehydrated, and he can throw that in there instead.
There you go. All right, cool. Next, I got a question from Alex. Hi, Rob. I've been suffering from depression for almost 4 years. The worst part is the early awakening insomnia that leaves me brain dead and tired. I have read that some people claim to have overcome their depression with a paleo diet. Is this true? If so, how? I have just read Potatoes, Not Prozac. The author tells people to have a potato before bed in order to get the tryptophan from your dinner. Past the blood-brain barrier. What do you make of this? I tried this, but to no avail. I've also eliminated dairy, wheat, sugar from my diet. I do feel better without these, my diet for sure. They have done nothing for insomnia / depression. I will attempt full paleo soon. I am reluctant because I already have a hard time keeping a smile on my face for work, and I know that the transition to a low-carb diet on mood and energy sucks. I tried it before the depression. I do remember my emotions were solid after a few days, and I was so excited that I finally found a diet that made me feel so good. Boy, was I disappointed when I started to get nauseous at the idea of more meat along with constipation. I guess I did not give myself the full 3 weeks to adapt. Any info on how paleo and brain chemistry would be a godsend? Thanks.
Oh, man. Depression can have a couple of different vectors. Like, there can be serotonin deficiency. There can be... key players, we have like serotonin, acetylcholine, dopamine. I'm blanking on a couple other, major players in usually anxiety is more of like an acetylcholine kind of gig instead of like overt depression. But all of these things get really, really heavily influenced by systemic inflammation, insulin levels, cortisol levels. Elevated cortisol can be problematic in that it actually degrades serotonin, and so that could be a problem. The fact that the potatoes, not Prozac, the idea behind that is kind of intriguing at first until you realize that a lot of people are actually getting too much serotonin in some ways due to a chronically high carbohydrate diet, and so you actually end up with some serotonin receptor site downregulation and kind of burnout. The paleo diet, especially when it's pushed a little bit more low carb, the ketosis kind of elevates dopamine. Dopamine is really the kind of go do achieve neurotransmitter. It is what makes you wake up. It makes you motivated. So the focus on serotonin is a little bit misplaced. Serotonin is important for sleep and for recovery and stuff like that. So over the weekend in Hoboken, I came up with this idea that the paleo diet is a little bit like shotgun art, you know, where they'll put like paints in a shotgun barrel and just like blast it out of the barrel along with the shot and everything, and then they make artwork with this stuff. The paleo diet is a little bit like that in that it's very much like a shotgun approach. It ends up addressing a bunch of different things all at once: systemic inflammation, elevated dopamine levels, optimizing serotonin levels. A lot of times you can go to a psychiatrist and get some pretty extensive blood work, pretty extensive neurological screening, and they still don't really know what specific neurotransmitters are problematic for your situation. But it's interesting, this kind of generalized paleo approach ends up addressing most issues kind of simultaneously and in synchrony. Throwing in the fish oil, like I would probably throw in the high dose fish oil, like definitely the 0.5 gram to 1 gram per 10 pounds of body weight per day. Make sure to supplement vitamin D. And that's what I would tackle on this. The constipation with this, it's interesting. It's rare that I see someone with this. Occasionally somebody will report constipation with kind of a paleo diet. Usually they've been eating a lot of bread or gluten prior to this event, and the gut irritants in these foods tends to increase their gastric motility. It pushes food through them because the gut is recognizing that it's being exposed to an irritant. That'll normalize after a couple of weeks. Drink a lot of water, eat a little more fat, and you should be fine with that. But I think if the depression is severe enough, and I had pretty I would say moderate to severe depression when I was living in Seattle, between the lack of sunlight, when I was sick from GI problems and kind of a vegan diet almost killing me, I would definitely take a little constipation over being depressed any day. So that's just me. But if Alex tweaks any of these variables, let us know what the changes are, good, bad, or otherwise, so that we can get that back to folks.
All right, good. Next, we got a question from unknown. Actually, it's not unknown, but somehow I lost the name.
Or we're just protecting their identity.
No, never mind. It's a joke for another time. We'll include that question maybe next week. Rob, love the show and your work. I will be one of the first to buy your book in Phoenix. I am 34-year-old male, 6'5", 210, 11% body fat. I have been CrossFit style training for close to a year, eating mostly paleo since the beginning of the year. Over the last few months, I have had major life changes, divorce, and a substantial increase in workload that has resulted in increased stress, poor sleep, and my training over the last month has cratered. I habitually rely on sugar-free energy drinks, and I swear am I addicted. What are some steps and a timeline to get off this poison? When I try cold turkey, I end up feeling like a zombie and can barely function. I have to use my brain for a living. I've taken your advice and done some Google searches, but I don't like the fact that the sites that I am reading are trying to sell me snake oil and telling me that it could be 2 years before I'm back to normal and no longer have to purchase their product. How does one suffering from adrenal fatigue start working back to normalcy? Keep up the great work, and I cannot wait for the book.
So the biggies here, like poor sleep, big stress, you know, it's a tough kind of feed forward mechanism that starts happening with this. You get into a stress filled environment, your sleep quality tanks, your insulin sensitivity decreases, which further makes you produce cortisol. And when it's very synergistic what these things do. Elevated cortisol increases insulin secretion. It decreases insulin sensitivity at the cell level. Then that increased insulin secretion actually further causes adrenocortical stimulation and causes a release of cortisol. So these things get just feed forward at like nothing else. And these energy drinks, the artificial sweeteners, cause problems with insulin dysregulation. So it you know, I get that it's a problem that you're going to feel like hell, you just kind of have to decide that you're going to pull the Band-Aid off and be done with it. You can certainly try titrating down. Like if you're doing six of them a day, try doing five a day for a couple of days, and then four a day, then three, then two, then one, and titrate down. I think titrating down on a specific schedule totally makes sense, but you will hit some point in which you're just going to have to deal with the suffering of getting over it. You know, Andy's going through that with the caffeine withdrawal. I've gone through it with the caffeine withdrawal before. A little bit of coffee can help all of that. Exercising can help. Appropriate dose, not trying to kill yourself. That's all totally legit, all very, very helpful. But the situation that starts getting set up here is somewhat of a downward spiral, and you just have to intervene and change direction, or else it's not going to get fixed.
I assume when he's talking about the sites that he's reading trying to sell him snake oil, I assume those are some of the adrenal fatigue sites.
I would guess so, yeah. Yeah.
And I guess what's your thoughts on that? Because I think we both have been through some adrenal fatigue stuff, and I don't know. I saw great benefits from some of the products. I think the challenge is, just like he's asking, is unfortunately for some of them, it can take a while till you don't really need that stuff to feel better.
Yeah, and I would definitely agree. Even built within that, like, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to train at the level of volume intensity that I've done in the past. Part of that, you know, I'm like 38 years old, so am I just kind of comparing with when I was 32 and kind of hitting my peak? I would hope not, but maybe. But there's definitely a reality in the literature when you look at overreaching, overtraining, and like general kind of high stress scenarios that people have dealt with. It can take a long time to fully recover from that. And I could lie and say something different, but that seems to be the reality. Now, the thing is that people will usually start feeling better, and then they can tend to overdo what they're doing, particularly in their training, or they will get a little bit cheeky with their sleep and start skimping on the sleep again, and then it kind of gets them right back to where they were. So I don't know how long it's going to take you to get back to normalcy, and I don't know what normalcy is going to be once you're there. Like, I don't know what your normal baseline is going to be. I know mine is, like, for me to feel good and, like, really feel good just day to day and be able to, like, think and write a book and be pleasant, at least somewhat pleasant to be around, like, I need to really keep an eye on my training and my general stress levels. And if one thing starts getting worse, you know, like if the book deadline starts getting really gnarly, then I have to really kind of dial back the training volume and intensity to keep that in mind. And you have to start keeping more of an eye on that. And especially if you've driven into this once or twice before, people who suffer heat exhaustion are more prone to succumbing to heat exhaustion in the future. And I see this as being really no different than that. Like, you just have to play the whole thing a little bit smarter and keep an eye on how you're feeling and dial things in appropriately. The adrenal fatigue supplements, you know, like the OrthoAdapt is really, really good. Phosphatidylserine definitely seems helpful. You have to use that in a smart way or else you can overdo it. I don't know. You know, without seeing specific numbers on this person and being able to manage them day by day, I don't know how long the process is going to take.
Yeah, and I know for me, I mean, I've used some of the Dr. James Wilson stuff, supplements, and been very happy with them. But then there's been periods of time where I've been super stressed, and I've noticed that I would need then to up my dosage back to sort of when I had, like, the worst adrenal fatigue symptoms.
Hmm.
And then I feel better. And so I talked to Dr. Garrett Smith a little bit about that, and he said, you know, some of it could be real. He's like, some of it is probably the placebo effect.
Right.
He's like, but it obviously works in your minds, which is enough to alleviate some of the symptoms. But, you know, it's one of those tough things because I'm kind of in the same boat where it's like some of the stuff, I'm like, wow, you know, how long do I need to take some of these glandular extracts? You know, do I really need to take these forever? Well, I hope not.
Right. Right. And, you know, I don't usually, I think, like, a couple of months and people start feeling quite a bit better. But the thing is that feeling quite a bit better then leads you to want to train or function kind of the way that you did before. But that's exactly what usually gets you into the problem. I just did a consult with a girl earlier who's a really prominent CrossFit Games, you know, hopeful, and she has sky high cortisol levels. I mean, like, up there, and it, you know, consistently up there. And there's some sleep disturbance going on and everything, and she's just a pipe hitting monster, like monster athlete. And we're going to play with some lifestyle things to try to get the testosterone cortisol ratio reestablished for her. But it's you know, just the lifestyle, the, you know, owning a gym, training, trying to compete on the schedule that is normal for kind of CrossFit Games kind of preparation or whatever. It doesn't really matter what it is that you're doing, but it, any of it can be too much. It is interesting, though, that the most athletic activities, you work hard into it. Like if you're a skier, if you're a jiu-jitsu player, whatever, you work hard into your specific sport. There were some really interesting studies looking at judo players in the like 96 Olympics or something like that. And what they found with the judokas is that they were constantly in a state of kind of low grade overreaching, overtraining. Hard training will elevate cortisol levels in general, but if you're doing that training smart, you will also see elevated testosterone levels, and the testosterone will outpace the cortisol increase. Where things start going south is when you either push so hard or for so long that we start seeing a suppression in testosterone levels. What they saw in these judoka was that when they would get ready to compete, they would taper, basically dial back their volume and intensity. They would supercompensate and then be really, really ready for game day. And that, you know, I think to some degree that's some of the fun that is made of periodization, is that to some degree all that you're doing is keeping a pulse on the person. And when they're getting ready to peak, you dial them back, let them supercompensate, let all that work capacity, all that extra volume that you've thrown in the back end, allows you to pop up to a supra normal level of performance. And then hopefully you time all of that. The challenge within some CrossFit type stuff is that because you vary the volume, the intensity, the movements, the structure, the pacing always, then you never really work hard into it. You are constantly assailed by a new stressor, which can be amazing for reversing metabolic derangement in somebody who's a type 2 diabetic, suppressing inflammation in somebody who's got rheumatoid arthritis or something. But that stimulus taken too far and too long can be really, really problematic. So that's the interesting world that we're in right now with this mixed modal stuff being as popular as it is.
Yep. All right, good. Next question from Nick. Rob, please help. I have been reading up on nightshades and I'm freaking out now. I eat probably 2 or 3 peppers a day, either with a salad or chopped up in an omelet. And I also throw in some tomatoes in that salad and roast eggplant and other veggies at night. Is it true these nightshades can cause such things as arthritis and cancer in the digestive tract? Should I cut these out? I feel like every time I start eating certain veggies, I find a new reason why I shouldn't eat them. I eat 100% paleo with a wide variety of veggies, but a large group are nightshades. If I keep eating them, am I in danger of these problems, or is it different for everyone?
Yeah, to some degree, it's different for everybody. The nightshades do have some gut-irritating constituents in them. Different people respond differently to varying levels. I think there's a great argument, you know, for just generally varying your food intake. I just find kind of naturally, like, I will be real heavy on tomatoes during the summer and whatnot, and then I tend to kind of decrease that intake, you know, during the winter months, and it just kind of fluctuates kind of naturally like that. Anybody with some serious inflammation or a overt autoimmune disease, I would definitely consider pulling the nightshades out and just see if you feel better. But, you know, I feel like I'm kind of the canary in the coal mine, and like if anything's going to mess with anyone, I'm the person that it messes with them. And I have not really noticed that much of a problem, if any type of a problem, from the nightshades. One thought with that, Bruce Ames, there used to be Bruce Ames is the guy that developed this thing called the Ames test, which is a measure of mutagenicity, how much DNA damage would be imbued into a particular population of bacteria. and there's a it's a quantifiable method of showing how much DNA damage like a particular substance can induce in an organism, you know, like a pesticide or like arsenic or something like that. And so in the Ames test, then you get a quantification of how much mutagenicity in that, how much mutagenicity is there. Then there's potential for carcinogens also. What Bruce Ames had found was that there is nothing that doesn't contain mutagens, carcinogens. When you look at the list, it's like apples, oranges, bananas, kiwis, strawberries, everything contains some sort of mutagenic, carcinogenic substance in some degree. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't ever have any of this stuff. It's just an argument for varying the amounts and varieties of the, particularly the fruits and vegetables that you're taking in, so that in you know, toxicologist geek speak, you would say you would diversify the toxin load, diversify the metabolic pathways that are being encumbered by detoxifying these different constituents, and then it's not really a big deal. That's kind of getting aside from just the potential gut irritation out of nightshades, but it's just something to keep in mind. You should not stress over it or freak out, but it's just something to kind of weave into your program, just some general variety.
Nightshades. Rob, step away from the apples.
I do what I can.
Anyway, cool. Next question from Kevin. Rob, Andy, been enjoying the podcast. At an intellectual level, I've been a paleo believer for several years, but I've never been able to tolerate the diet. I know what you're thinking. Here's another guy who's ODing on bananas and almond butter, but I've given it an honest shot many times and usually land in the ER with level 10 abdominal pain. My issue is the fruits and vegetables, especially vegetables. I've been gluten-free for a couple of years. I know that I've developed sensitivity to some good paleo foods, but I avoid them. Recently, I confirmed an overgrowth of yeast fungus in my gut. Interestingly, it's not
Candida albicans.
Thank you. But rather something unique that the lab was not able to specifically type. It seems to feed on all things fiber. I'm confident that this is the source of my problem. My current survival diet does consist of an excess of nuts. The fiber in nuts does not seem to bother me as much. Aside from that and the minimal fruits and vegetables, the rest of my diet is paleo. I compensate for the nuts with high doses of fish oil. I take lots of vitamins and drink lemon juice to maintain natural pH. I'm trying to load up on probiotics, antifungals, and gradually increase well-cooked veggies and some fruits. I'm 42, 5'9", and 150 pounds. A little leaner than I'd like to be, but body comp is surprisingly good given that I really rarely feel good enough to put in a decent workout. Sleep quality is terrible. I haven't heard you guys comment on the role of gut flora yet. I'd be really interested to know if you've run anything like this or have thoughts about how a person with dysbiosis can best make the conversion to paleo.
Wacky. You know, the sleep quality there could simply be some cortisol release, stress release out of the gut, just simply the gut being exposed to this kind of wacky yeast. There's a product, Jaro Formulas makes it called Saccharomyces boulardii, and we can put a link into the show notes on that. Saccharomyces boulardii is actually a highly beneficial gut yeast. It's found on some tropical fruits. It's kind of interesting. It actually has been very, very effective in treating some forms of dysentery and whatnot. But, you know, you could really try dosing heavily with the Saccharomyces boulardii. And under normal circumstances, you would try to put in some gut bacteria like the Lactobacilli and Bifidium species. But I think in this situation, going yeast versus yeast would probably be smarter. Although if he's on the fluconazole, that could be a little bit of a problem. But he could start doing a mixed bag of doing both a bacteria supplementation with like a New Chapter or a Jaro Formulas. Like Jaro has Jarodophilus, like a really big dose Acidophilus Bifidum mix, about 12 different species. And then also do the Saccharomyces boulardii. And hopefully in the process of that, displace these nastier yeast that are causing problems. And that would be the direction I would go with it. You know, the whole psychoneuroimmunology, like the gut health that stems from our bacterial flora is just a huge topic. We've touched on it peripherally a little bit. Like, I definitely like probiotics, but that's just a whole other probably episode in and of itself that, although informational, would probably put folks to sleep. But I mean, the bottom line is this is part of why most indigenous species have some sort of a fermented food, whether it's yogurt or sauerkraut or kimchi or, you know, something like that. The repopulation of our gut flora is a pretty interesting and important aspect of health. It's really weird, but the bacteria actually are legitimately our first, I don't want to say line of defense, but our first line of interaction of the gut contents in our intestines and us. Because really, if our gut is healthy, it's not just the gut contents interacting the cells themselves, like the cell membranes of the villi and the microvilli and the, say, like the small intestine. It's actually a layer of bacteria, beneficial flora, and these beneficial flora are actually doing a bunch of chemical converting different constituents, like vitamins, converting them from provitamins into actual vitamins and whatnot. There's a zillion different things that the gut bacteria do, and they also help protect us from parasitic and opportunistic bacteria and viruses, in this case yeast. I bet that we could probably trace back some sort of an illness. If we dug around with Kevin, I bet we could find some sort of a precipitating event with this that probably predisposed him to this wacky gut bug that he has.
All right, good. Good question.
Yeah, definitely. Interesting stuff.
Now we snuck one in on the supplement. Only because it's pimped by Mike Mahler. So anyway,
there we go. Yeah.
Question from Anthony. Hey, Rob, thanks for all you do, brother. You're a true inspiration. I have a question about Sun Warrior protein. It's rice-based and heavily praised by Mike Mahler. They even claim a 90% correlation to mother's milk. Would love to hear your thoughts when you do your supplement podcast. Thanks again. Anthony, podcast listener number 6.
Man, if even drawing a correlation between rice and boobs, just... I can't say how much that bums me out. So, you know, it's good. It's comparatively, this rice-based type protein, like the Sun Warrior stuff, is hypoallergenic. Most people are not allergic or have significant gut problems from rice. The biggest problem with rice, although it does have some immunological problems with GERD. So whether people are doing a rice protein or just generally doing rice as a meal, a lot of folks will experience GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease. This is made worse when the carbohydrate content is high and the lectin content of the grains are there, because it's not just an insulin deal. It's also kind of an immunological factor. And when you put the two in combination, then that's where we have a problem. I would just kind of beg the question, like, why exactly are you doing this? If you're doing the Mike Mahler thing and you want to be vegan, eating concentrated rice, bean, and pea proteins to prove that, you know, concentrating this stuff in a chemical vat instead of feeding it to animals and eating them somehow works, then, you know, knock yourself out. But I don't see the point of any of this stuff. Occasionally, you'll have somebody with some serious GI problems where they have like multiple chemical sensitivities, multiple allergies. They react to like fish, eggs, beef, chicken, everything, but they're a low reactor to rice. And that might be an argument for using some sort of a rice-based protein powder until their gut normalizes and they can start, via elimination diet, they downregulate some of the antigens to things like chicken or beef or lamb or whatever. They can find some things that they don't have problems with. It could plug the gap in that case, but otherwise I'm a little stumped into the utility of a product like this. Is that more neutral than what you were expecting, or Andy's laughing?
No, rice and beans are not protein, Rob.
They're third world proteins.
No disrespect to Mahler.
He pulls it off, and you know, props to him for it. But again, like, if you really want to impress me on that stuff, just eat these foods in an unprocessed format. Eat beans and rice, and split peas, and then how are you doing? But when you take this stuff and you process it in what is essentially the same way that happens when we feed it to an animal, you know, you're just doing a paleo-esque diet I'm not even sure what the thing is establishing, other than it just proves that if you want to be muscular and have good performance, you need to eat fairly high amounts of protein and fat. You know, so in some ways it's just a validating point of the whole kind of paleo protein concept, but you know, to each their own. So
yep. All right, good. Next, we got a question from Mike. Just thought of one more thing I sent along after that long list of questions. I know a lot of people will try to use almond meal to bread chicken or make paleo pancakes or stuff like that. I've always been concerned about oxidizing the PUFAs and the nuts when baking or frying them. Kurt Harris of the PANU blog recently commented on that as well in this post, and I was curious about your thoughts. So first of all, I want to comment that Kurt Harris names his post really cool. This one was called Smoking Candy Cigarettes.
Yes, I remember that one. That one's good.
So let's start there, Rob. Any thoughts on that?
You know, it could be a factor. Like, we're just moving so much more towards kind of a low nut consumption deal because of the short chain omega-6s. It seems kind of compelling to at least limit this stuff. I know there was a time when I was eating just almonds by the pound a day. You know, I would make the nutty hot cereal and it was really good. I'd throw down nuts with all my meals. I was taking lots and lots of fish oil, and I had some inflammation problems that I do not have now. Using like more coconut milk. I've even been dabbling with a little bit more pastured butter, and I don't really have a problem with that. So I think that there's an argument for this, and like, depending on how you're cooking it, you definitely, you know, like the linoleic acid in the short chain omega-6 that is in, say, like almonds, it's not a huge amount of it, but it's enough that you could end up with some reactive oxygen species, like the oxidized fats, that we're really trying to avoid. And, you know, it is kind of an argument in that case for at least minimizing the intake of really thoroughly cooked products like that. But then, you know, when we do our paleo pancakes and it has like brown rice flour and all those things, you're making acrylamides and some other nasties, which there again, it's kind of like, okay, how much life do you want to live? How much of these snacky foods do you want? Where's the balance and all that? And I think just, you know, understanding that daily consumption of that stuff might add up into being a problem at some point, and keeping it more for kind of treats be my answer to that.
All right. And part two, also saw this the other day, and while some aspects of it were a little over my head, thought you might find it interesting. I'm sure you have more depth and understanding of it than I do. So this is from Hyperlipid blog titled Gluten Does Celiac Disease Require an Infection?
That's something that, you know, I've wondered about actually for a long time, and there's some data that would kind of indicate that some sort of a combination of gut flora change, you know, like a candida infection, very, very common for people who've developed giardia, the amoebic kind of dysentery kind of gig. That stuff just waylays the gut lining, lays it open, damages it, and makes it possible for other confounding problems to occur in the gut, including celiac disease. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't some sort of a gut antigen pathogen kind of deal set up here, where you're exposed to some sort of a grain, legume, dairy, or maybe a nightshade, and then there's damage that is caused by a pathogen, and that there could be some, you know, I don't know if that is absolutely necessary for all situations, but I think that it could be a very, very common causative factor in the whole thing. The thing that arises then is that it is not uncommon to get some sort of a gut pathogen, you know, whether it's a virus, bacteria, So it doesn't really, you know, you'd have to live then in a completely sterile environment to then decrease your likelihood of developing, say, celiac or gluten intolerance or something along that line. The one thing that is interesting with this, though, is that in kids, newborns in particular, they theoretically would not have had a gut pathogen as of yet, but they tend to react very, very strongly to directly to lectins being fed to them, also to lectins that are in the mother's milk. So that, you know, I think there's something to this. I think anytime you irritate an area, say like with a bacterial or viral infection, something like Giardia, the likelihood of collateral damage like celiac would be much greater. But I can think of some situations where you would not directly look at it and say, okay, we had a gut pathogen and now we've got an intolerance to grains or legumes. I can see some scenarios like that too, but it's really interesting.
Yep. All right, good. That was a good question.
I like yeah.
That. If only you could name your blog posts Cooler Rob, I feel like we'd be improving.
Dude, the one today was about Edo. How much more cool can you get than that? Edo Portal, folks. So.
That's because Edo is cool, not because you come up with cool taglines.
Again, I do what I can. So.
Anyway. next question from Terry. I really appreciate the type 1 diabetes information. My trainer is very concerned about my level of training. So often printed material is so basic and then ends with verify with your doctor, who more often than not has little additional guidance. I really found the article interesting, but I need some explanations and or plain English to use the advice you offer, e.g. exercise-induced glucose release, adrenal hormone facilitation, VO2 max, though I've heard the last term. Your 3 points require a better understanding, or I need to know mine. I do high and low intensity workouts, including CrossFit and kettlebells, and I do endurance running, marathons, 13 at this writing, and plan this winter season to do more 5 and 10K runs. Goal for spring or summer is to complete a triathlon. I also follow a paleo diet, but not religiously. Usually my H1Cs are in the high 6s or very low 7s. This mid-50s guy, type 1 since early 20s, would very much appreciate your clarification assistance to improve or disimprove his exercise and or lifestyle. I have only found my glucose levels to improve or be consistent with regularity and exercise over the years. My trainer is a little henny-penny at the moment, so I could use the clarification.
Okay, A1Cs in the 6s and 7s are sky high, like really, really high. Not to light a fire under Terry, but this is indicative of massively accelerated rate of aging, kidney function declining, potential like diabetic neuropathy, blindness. Like if that were me, I would want those numbers way lower. I would do everything in my power to try to get those things down under 5. There's no doubt that to some degree you're getting better blood sugar control from exercise. Exercise provides an alternate path for the body to utilize glucose, to bring glucose into the muscle cells and act as a sink for glucose. That's great. The problem that we find is that high volume, high intensity work, what I mentioned and what wasn't clear because of the technical terms, exercise-induced glucose release. When we exercise hard and or long or both, then we release cortisol. And that cortisol causes our liver to release glucose, and our blood sugar levels can be as high, a very, very large carb. And this, the high blood sugar levels in type 1s come from, and we see these particularly high, 200s and 300s in some cases, after people have done very high intensity training. And there was a way back when it was like Teresa and some other guy, or at least they were all over my junk about the type 1 diabetes recommendations. But she was basically bragging about the fact that she was going to motor through multiple marathons and triathlons and everything else, and her A1Cs pretty much be damned. She would just control blood sugar levels with her insulin. But she already had signs and symptoms of stuff not going well. And so, the basic deal here is that high-intensity exercise causes hormonal release of glucose out of the liver. That is independent of diet. A shitty diet on top of that. Oh, sorry, Heather Dalton. I promised her I was going to try not to to curse because she tries to let the kids listen to this thing. She gave us a lift from Hoboken to New York, so I'm going to try to clean it up. Bad diet is a problem in this too, obviously, and the oxidative stress that comes out of this, it just nothing good comes from this. And what I've recommended is a mapping of what your blood glucose levels are in response to various bouts of exercise, and to do everything you can to keep your blood sugar as low and consistent as you possibly can. A1Cs in the sixes and sevens are horrible, in my opinion. Like, absolutely horrible. So I hope Terry affects some change. I hope that clarifies the topic. And again, this is just my opinion on it. I could be wrong, but the stuff that we've seen, even a recent, I think we posted this not too long back, the A1Cs being better predictor of cardiovascular disease, cancer, a whole host of other problems, because it's showing how much glucose is in the system over time, and oxidative stress and all kinds of other problems.
So maybe just in layman's terms, can you explain a little bit more about the concept of how like Terry would go about mapping his response to various bouts of exercise and then what he would do with that information?
So let's say you're going to do, let's compare a couple of different workouts. Let's compare a strength workout versus a mixed modal Metcon workout versus like a long, slow distance, lowish intensity cardio workout, just kind of jogging. So like on the weight training workout, let's say it's 8 sets of 3 on back squat, 8 sets of 3 on the standing press. You're taking 2 or 3 minutes rest between each event. This is classic strength training. What the individual should notice off of a training session like that is a very modest, if any, uptick in their blood glucose from doing that strength workout, because there just wasn't that much of a neuroendocrine demand on their body. They weren't using a lot of glucose, and so they didn't need to replace a lot of glucose. So there wouldn't be that much of a hormonal stress to release glucose out of the liver to balance out the blood glucose levels. Now, in the case of a mixed modal CrossFit workout, let's say like a run, kettlebell swing, pull-up, like a classic Helen kind of thing, if you're going after this hard, you are just sending a massive signal to remove glucose out of the blood. And in some ways, that could be really good. You can affect some really great blood glucose level changes if the rest of your endocrine system is normal. A fast run, kettlebell swings with pull-ups, you're working like virtually every muscle group in the body. You're working them at or near exhaustion, at least in the short term, and that is exactly what you want to do to decrease muscle glycogen. And when you decrease the muscle glycogen, then you are going to increase the rate of uptake of blood glucose. When you pull blood glucose into the muscles because of a change in the concentration gradient, when there's less glucose in the muscle than outside the muscle, then it's going to pull or wick glucose into the muscle, to say nothing of the improvement in the insulin sensitivity. So there's multiple ways of now pulling glucose into the muscle. When that blood sugar starts crashing, your body will release cortisol to bring the blood glucose levels back up out of the liver. The problem that arises for the type 1 diabetic is that the lack of an insulin signal, normally you would release a whack of cortisol that would bring blood glucose levels up a little bit, and then you would have an immediate little release in insulin, and that insulin actually blunts the release of glucose out of the liver. This is a really important feature of insulin that we haven't really talked about a lot. It makes sense once you wrap your mind around it, but it's a little counterintuitive. In the type 1 diabetic, the biggest problem that they have with blood sugar maintenance is from the lack of insulin preventing glucose release out of the liver. And so that becomes really problematic. And because a type 1 diabetic does not have normal insulin signaling, they do not release insulin in response to food, in response to normal blood glucose increases, then we have a serious problem set up there. And so a really hard exercise bout can send blood glucose levels skyrocketing because you get a cortisol signal, which is a signal to raise blood glucose levels, but no concomitant insulin signal to turn blood glucose production off at the liver. And so that's where you need to map that type of a workout, figure out what type of volumes and intensities produce what type of blood glucose levels. Now, a long, slow distance jog or a row or something like that, like a 60, 70% max heart rate, because that's low intensity, we should be able to shift our body over to predominantly fat mobilization for that type of work. And so we should see less of a blood glucose uptick, but we will typically see some uptick because you're going to, again, pull some glucose out of the blood, put it in the muscles. The body is going to respond by a release of a little bit of cortisol and in an attempt to raise blood glucose levels, but it should be less than what we would see in that really hard mixed modal training scenario. So then with this data, the individual can look at what their blood glucose levels are in response to a given type of exercise, volume of exercise, intensity of exercise, and then they can start making some informed decisions about what their training should look like such that they're healthier.
Good. And if that's not enough clarification, Terry, let us know, but I thought it was important just to kind of clarify because I think we have a couple other questions in the queue kind of similar that they enjoyed the post, but there was some confusion, I think, about some of the technical terms and what exactly it meant to them.
Cool. So, and you know, at some point when we get the new site and we start getting some diagrams of this stuff up, it'll make a lot more sense because, you know, the whole picture, 1,000 words kind of thing, like we can animate this stuff, put a diagram up there, and it'll clarify all this information a lot.
Nice. Rob Wolf teasing his new site. Uh-oh. Don't worry, folks. I just found out about it yesterday, so you're almost ahead of me.
We got to keep Andy in the dark. As he, without the coffee, he just doesn't handle change very well.
That's right, and I cause trouble. So anyway. Moving on, question from Darren. Loving the podcast. I've been following the blog for a long time. The info my buddy brought back to Diablo CrossFit after your first nutrition cert has been life-changing for our gym. We have numerous people who have seen huge gains in weight loss and performance on unmeasured paleo. My question is, me and a buddy of mine were thinking about the article that Rip put out called The Novice Effect, or The Novice Effect, I guess. More appropriate. And we're wondering if there are any other alternatives to milk as a weight gainer. We both don't do very well with milk, and we're wondering if there is a paleo-ish alternative to milk. Maybe a whey protein and healthy fat? I've heard a dozen eggs can be subbed as well. Any thoughts?
You know, the thing that we're just... There's two things here. There's total caloric load, which you can get by any means. And, you know, coconut milk, just eating more, you know, just any type of calorically dense items are helpful. The deal with dairy is it's easy to get down a bunch of it. A gallon of it is like 3,500 calories. So if you want to take in just disgusting amounts of calories, and you can eat 4 large meals a day and then somehow fit a gallon of milk in between that, and you could be upwards of 7,000-8,000 calories a day, and really not that hard to do. But there is a reality that dairy has growth potential above and beyond simply its caloric content. And this is both an opportunity and a potential problem. You have some problems with insulin dysregulation. You have some potential in like my opinion and Cordain's opinion, potential of breast, colon, prostate cancer type problems because of the increased epithelial growth factors, endothelial growth factors, like every growth factor in the body is flipped on because normally the only time that we consume dairy is as a baby, you know, when we're growing. So it's not just the caloric content. So, I mean, there's not really like a paleo alternative per se. It's just figuring out how you want to tackle this thing. If the milk, if the primary problem that you experience is the lactose, you know, some sort of lactose intolerance, then you may do better with yogurt. You may do just fine with like they said, a whey protein shake, and then throw in coconut milk to round out the fat and get more caloric content in and all that sort of stuff. But just keep in mind that any type of dairy derivative, whey protein, cheese, whatever, it's still going to have those insulinogenic elements of the overall dairy. It just may not have the lactose if your main problem is some sort of a GI problem.
Yeah, I think that's where I'd give a plug if they haven't played with some goat's milk, because I know for you mm-hmm. or I, we both don't tolerate cow's milk very well, but generally do pretty good when we do eat goat's milk.
Yeah, totally. And it is goat-erific, too, so.
Yeah, some people complain about the taste. I don't know what they're talking about. I think it tastes great.
Awesome. Yeah. Yep.
Cool. Well, with that, Rob, 55 minutes, that ends episode 24.
Woohoo! Survived yeah. another. Sweet.
Another one in the book.
The cool. post-caffeine withdrawal episode.
Yep. We'll see in next week if my energy levels continue to increase or if I hit a slump week three. We'll see.
I'm betting on increased energy levels. I think there's some sun in our future, too. So.
Oh, nice. That would yeah. make me happy. Oh, that looks nice today. Cool, man. Well, thank you, and we will talk to you next week.
Awesome, Andy. Thanks.
All right. See you, Rob.
Bye.